So, as you might know, I started a postdoc here in last January. So I thought it would be a good idea to tell you about my latest research interests. So basically, this work was developed like in the past 2 years in collaboration with Lorenzo Cornalva, Miguel Costa, and Ricardo Schiappa. So okay, let me start by giving you some brief motivation for this work, if needed at all. So the first obvious motivation is to actually describe real high energy scattering in QCD. So here, if we take all the parameters, so S and T, much larger than the confinement scale, then conformal symmetry is useful, and we can describe, we can hope to describe QCD, real QCD, using our, conformal field theory, like say Encol's four super young mills. In fact, we have to be cautious because, like for example, the total cross section is dominated by T very small, so very small transfer, momentum transfer, and so it's the so-called soft Pomeroy behavior, which is very sensitive to the confinement physics, and of course it's not included in this description. But for example, another example is in deep inelastic scattering, when again one works at the large virtuality of the photon and the small Bjorken X. Again, one is sensitive to this high energy scattering process in the conformal regime. So that's another important application of this. On a more conceptual side, we are also very interested in understanding high energy scattering in gravitational theories, and in particular in an AVS background. So the basic idea here is just to try to generalize the work done in high energy scattering in flat space string theory to an AVS background. So for example, in this talk, we'll be essentially living with string effects, so regization of the single graviton exchange, and also the Iconal approximation. The last two topics I'll leave for future research or as open questions if you want. So okay, this is basically the map of this talk, like the basic summary of what we're going to do. So in most of this talk, I'll be working in the standard N equals 4 super young mills example, dual to so type 2b in AVS 5 cross S5. So in the first row here, we have the planar limit without any string interactions or if you want, or 1 over n effects. So we'll start, at strong toothed coupling, where the gravity description is good, and essentially a single graviton exchange in the T channel is a good description of the high energy scattering process. Then as we move, as we decrease the toothed coupling, or if you want, we need to include alpha prime corrections, and the leading effect is that instead of exchanging the single graviton, we have to exchange the full regi trajectory of the graviton. Then we have the other end, so it's weakly coupled conformal field theory. Here we know, since the 70s, since the work of Lipatov and collaborators, Balitsky, Fazev, and Kurev, that essentially the leading at very high energies, the cross section, or sorry, the scattering amplitude is dominated by the exchange of two gluons, where these two gluons are in a singlet state, in a color singlet state, and they basically form what's called the Pomeroy, the hard Pomeroy. And when you turn on the coupling, you have to take into account all these leather interactions, where here you have regized gluons, and this is like the BFKL description of this effective particle, which is the bomber. So in this talk, we will see that we are able to describe all this first row in a unified formalism, like going from single gravitons to two gluons, if you want. Then we will also be interested in the first corrections in the vertical axis, so including the leading 1 over n effects. On the gravity side, again, this amounts to including many soft graviton exchanges, which can be reliably resummed in the Iconal approximation. Here in the weakly coupled side, it's more, I mean, the situation is more complicated. Basically, this is, again, this is where I'm working now. So from the weakly coupled descriptions, there is phenomena of saturation, of multi-Pomeron. Some Pomeron interactions need to be taken into account. So we will comment on that, but that's basically, again, work for the future. So okay, we will start in this left corner here, which is essentially where we have a better classical understanding, a better intuitive understanding of the process we want to describe. But before that, let me just very briefly review or introduce notation, if you want, for anti-de Sitter space. So okay, for me, anti-de Sitter space will be like this pseudosphere in an embedding space with two times and d space-like directions. So it's this blue hyperboloid pictured here for the case of AVS2, which in fact then we should unwrap and take the universal cover, which is plotted in this strip here. On the other hand, we have the boundary of AVS. The boundary of AVS I will define as the set, as the, essentially the light cone in this picture, so the set of null vectors in this the same embedding space up to rescalings. So do you see, I mean, here intuitively, the boundary of this hyperboloid, it's precisely this light cone at infinity. So this is my working definition for the boundary. If you want then to come back to any usual definition as Minkowski space or R3 times S, essentially one has to take a section of the light cone as a representative of a point of the boundary, just to remove this scaling redundancy. So okay, this is AVS and its boundary. So now for this talk, we will be working with high energy particles. So essentially particles moving along null geodesics. Again, in this language, null geodesics are very easy to describe in AVS. Null geodesics in AVS are just null geodesics in the embedding space. So they are just given by a point plus a fine parameter plus null vector. The only restriction we have to put is that the point has to be in AVS, and then the scalar product between the point and the massless vector has to be zero. And if you satisfy this, the null geodesic is always in AVS, and it's a null geodesic for AVS. If you want, it's plotted here, and since it reaches the boundary in finite time, we can then extend by reflections, but that's not needed, in fact. So, okay, I mean, nobody complained so far about me telling you about high energy scattering in AVS, but this is not well defined. Well, what do I mean by energy scattering in AVS? There's no S matrix. There's no asymptotic state, so what's scattering in AVS? So that's why I started here in this left-hand corner, where we have a classical picture. So in AVS, what we know is that if we take two very high energetic particles, they will follow this kind of null geodesics. So if we take two null geodesics, we should be able to describe some weak interaction between these two null geodesics exchanging some soft particles. But this is a classical picture, so we need to define wave functions associated with these high energetic particles. And the way to do it is to define wave functions associated not with a single null geodesic, but with a null congruence. So we need to find a set of null geodesics that generate AVS that is associated with the wave function of a particle moving at very high energy. Exactly like a plane wave is associated with a congruence of null geodesics with that null momentum. So we've just seen that given a null vector in the embedding space, we can describe a null surface in ADS. So this null surface which is generated by a set of null geodesics. So basically by this condition here, x dot k defines that surface in ADS. Recall that a null vector is also a point on the boundary. It's precisely the point where this null surface touches the boundary. So the question is, how to extend this to the rest of the space-time? Okay, but before doing that, we should take two, right? We have two particles scattering one against the other. So I'll take, say, vector k1 associated with particle 1 and k2 with particle 2. This defines two null surfaces like this. And the intersection is precisely hyperbolic space, so d minus 1 hyperbolic space. This will be our impact parameter space. You see the null geodesics, you can measure the geodesic distance between these null geodesics inside this surface along this hyperboloid. And the geodesic distance is our impact parameter of the process. Okay, so now extend this hypersurface to the full ADS. The idea is very simple. We just introduce coordinates in ADS using the Lorentz generators of the embedding space, so conformal transformation, if you want. So we start from the hyperboloid, from the transverse impact parameter space. Then we act with this Lorentz generator, which essentially generates the null geodesics, so the affine parameter along the null geodesics. And then we move this hypersurface up and down using another orthogonal, so essentially the other null vector, the other Lorentz generator associated with the other null vector. So basically you have a map of the coordinates defined like that. Here you have the congruence of parallel null geodesics and then the other coordinate V, which only covers this part of the ADS. So now it's very easy to say what the wave function is in these coordinates. The wave function essentially has to be independent of the affine parameter so that it describes particles propagating along these lines. And it has to have a very high frequency with respect to the other null coordinate, so which is V in this case. So you just put each exponential of minus I omega V, so a very high omega, and then we can put any smooth transverse modulation where the derivatives of this function f are very small compared to omega. Here I choose to actually localize this function f of v along the v equals zero surface so that I don't go into this more complicated region. I will localize my wave functions in the null surfaces of the previous slide, just on the original ones. But I have to take into account that this localization has to be smooth compared with the frequency. Okay, now that we have the wave functions and we have this interpretation of the wave functions as high energetic particles, we can just write the diagram, so the ladder diagram we want to resum. So okay, I wrote this long expression, which is, I mean, here I'm doing scalar for simplicity, scalar exchange. You have propagators along the horizontal lines, and then you have propagators along the vertical, and which are, you sum over all the permutations. This is essentially what you should be able to resum. And if you go and look at the original derivation in flat space, this is done in momentum space. And the main point in the iconal derivation is that the horizontal propagators are approximately on shell. So here, the particle basically moves on shell, follows its classical trajectory. But it's much more intuitive if you do it in position space. So in position space, essentially this amounts to saying that the horizontal propagators in this diagram are replaced by this function. So you have delta functions along the transverse coordinates, and then you have like a theta function along the affine parameter, saying that you can only propagate along the classical trajectory and for the future. So now, I mean, with this approximation, you can basically do this in our head. So you see, all these integrals collapse to affine integrals, except one, and then you have an integrals over ordered affine parameters. But then you have sum over permutations, so you can neglect the ordering. And since you have two ordered integrals, you have to divide over 1 over n factorial. So you have a sum over 1 over n factorial, you're going to get an exponential. So the final result is essentially given by an integral over the transverse space, so the space integral over all null geodesics in these congruences, and then a phase related with the interaction between each null geodesic. So essentially, if you want, it's just pick the three-level diagram of interaction between this point and this point, integrate along the affine parameter of this null geodesic and the affine parameter of the other one, exponentiate, and that's your iconal expression. So you see here we did it for a scalar, but we can do, I mean, this expression goes through for any spin exchange here in the T-channel. Moreover, this integral then, so this integral over affine parameters of the transverse of the propagator in AVS can be done exactly as in flat space, and we obtain again the propagator, but now in transverse space. So here, this is the scalar propagator in the impact parameter space, so in hyperbolic space, and multiplied by this s to the j minus n. I mean, this expression is written to be exactly like in flat space. The only change here is that the propagator goes from flat transverse space to hyperbolic space, and s, now you have to remember that s is the appropriate generalization is this scalar product between the null vectors. It's not the total energy, it's the scalar product between the null vectors, which is the same in flat space. Okay, just okay. Comment here, again, as in flat space, you see the j, there's s to the positive power of j. So at large s, at large energies, the highest spin dominates. So you have the graviton dominance, as usual in high energy processes. Okay, so now we know how to compute scattering amplitude for these iconal wave functions in AVS. So now we, yes, go ahead.
So you're considering basically a free scalar field in AVS. You're interacting.
You mean the incoming particles or?
I mean the interaction. I guess is it, I'm wondering what you're assuming about the interaction.
Basically, it can be anything. The most relevant ones are the interactions of the external particles with the graviton. Because, I mean, you can also exchange scalar particles, but just from the previous formula, you see that they are subdominant. If you put a scalar, it as S is large, it's subdominant.
Your scalar propagator, that's just the propagator.
No, even, sorry, that maybe I wasn't clear. Even if you, when you exchange a graviton, this propagator is a scalar propagator. When you integrate, so if you take this diagram and you exchange a graviton here and you do this integral of affine parameters, what you get is the scalar propagator in transverse space.
On a hyperbola.
On the hyperbola. Okay. Okay, but now that we have this result, we want to connect with the dual CFT. So what do we know? We know the usual Witten recipe. So we know that the four-point function of the CFT, recall that P's for me are points in the CFT, which are like momentum in AVS, but are points in CFT, not momentum. is given by basically summing all written diagrams in ADS, which in our previous language, this kind of written diagram corresponds to putting a wave function, which is just the boundary to bulk propagator. So instead of putting here a generic wave function, we put the boundary to bulk propagator. On the other hand, we can build any wave function in ADS just by superposing bulk to boundary propagators. So what we know is that if we can find superpositions, say phi, of bulk to boundary propagators, such that the wave functions in the bulk are of the iconal type, then we know the result of the amplitude. So essentially what we know is that there's an integral of the four-point function that is given by our iconal expression. So before building that, what do we know more about the four-point function? We know a lot, because I mean, conformal symmetry fixes it basically up to a function of the cross ratios. So in my notation here, you can just essentially by conformal invariance, you can write it in this form where these p's are here to have the correct conformal transformation, and then you have a generic function of the invariant cross ratios, which I define like this. Yes, this is the definition of Z and Z bar. Okay. I should mention, when you take Euclidean conformal field theory, Z and Z bar are complex conjugate, but for me they are not. So I can, if you take generic P's that can be Lorentzian, then Z and Z bar can be both real. So take it as independent variables. Okay.
The amplitude A of Z, Z bar, is it symmetric in Z and Z bar?
Yes. Okay. Just from the pictures that we have seen in the bulk computation, we saw that the iconal wave functions correspond essentially to particles going like this. So we expect that these points, so we expect that the point P1 be associated with the initial, so the incoming position of the null of the null geodesics, point P3 to be associated with the final point, so K1, and so we expect this kind of support for these sources on the boundary. And if you replace this, you get Z and Z bar equals zero. So the kinematics we are looking in the CFT, it's small cross ratios. But we have to be more precise, because if we look again at that picture, you will see that these points, so the cross ratios are going to zero, but not as in the usual way. Usually the cross ratio is going to zero when you take one point close to the other. Here, that's not the case. The points are going to minus the other, so they are going to the other, but in another Riemann sheet, if you want. So basically, let's say it like this. You have to take the four points with these causal relations, and the fact that you're going to high energy means that here you're going almost null. So you're going like related, but not the distance is going to zero, but in a Lorentzian sense. That's just what I want to mean. Okay. In fact, you can relate this to the Euclidean four-point function. So if you start from the Euclidean four-point function and then you recrotate to this kind of configuration, what you see is that your cross ratio, what happens is that you can fix the cross ratio Z bar and rotate the cross ratio Z around the branch points at 0 and 1 of your four-point function, and then take the limit Z bar going to 0. So what we are studying, it's the behavior of this four-point function, which I will call the Lorentzian four-point function, which is this analytic continuation of the Euclidean four-point function. So you take the four-point function, take Z around 0 and 1, And this is your Euclidean four-point function. It's a different sheet.
Did you say how you see that? Is that obvious?
No, this is not obvious. This is just doing it. So basically, you take your points. For example, the easiest way is you take your points here in ADS. So you write it in global coordinates, and then you rotate global time. And you follow this rotation. So you will see that the cross ratios, so when you're Euclidean, they are complex conjugate. Then they, as you re-rotate, they will move. And basically, they will move essentially, they will move like in the same direction, both. So this is equivalent to keeping one fixed and rotating the other around the branch points. So they don't follow complex conjugate paths, if you want, when you take this one. But yeah, I also would like to have a more intuitive and...
In global ADS, you have this multi-cover of the standard sheet, and the Euclidean configuration doesn't know that. So you have to go around somehow to get that extra looping.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, you see that the sources were in different Poincaré patches. You cannot put everything in the same Poincaré patches. So you need a different sheet of your four-point function. So okay, before giving you the result about so this small ZZBR behavior of this Lorentzian amplitude, we'll need to open a parenthesis and need this result about conformal partial waves. So in a conformal field theory, we can always expand any four-point function in a sum of conformal partial waves, where a conformal partial wave corresponds to a single exchange of a primary of dimension E and spin J. So any four-point function can be expanded in these PEs and written as a sum of exchange of primaries. So, okay, if you study this carefully and then from the Euclidean expression here, take the analytic continuation and then take the limit of small ZZ bar, you get...
Where S is totally determined by the dimension.
Yes, this function S is something totally determined, yes. It's not known in closed form in all dimensions, but it's known like a boundary condition and differential equation. But in four dimensions, it's known explicitly. It's some hypergeometric function of this cross rates. So if you take that and you consider the limit of small ZZ bar, exactly as in flat space, you arrive at an impact parameter representation. So here I really don't have time to explain this in detail. But the point is that, okay, this is some explicit expression which is a bit long, but let me just emphasize the main point. So exactly as in flat space, you have integrals over some kind of transverse space, some kind of impact parameter space. I will explain better why. Then you have some... like a plane wave, and then you have a phase shift. This is to think like the phase shift of a partial wave expansion in flat space. Yes. So okay, and in fact, if you do this in the process, you learn that this phase shift is in fact associated with the anomalous dimension. So the full dimension of the primary exchanged here in this channel, but I will.
The sum over J becomes this integral.
Yes, exactly as in flat space, when you change from the sum over J to an integral over impact parameter, this is the analogous result. But here you have sum over J and E, if you want. Yeah, so you get two integrals basically. Morally, that's it. I mean. I really don't have time to explain in more detail this result. Okay, but having this result, now it's a triviality, because now we can just plug this in our expression for the iconal amplitude, where we had an integral of the four-point function equal the iconal amplitude. We replaced the four-point function by this, and with a choice of with an appropriate choice of sources, we can match the two sides. And in fact, we get the natural result, which is that the phase shift on the other side is just this phase shift. So you get that the phase shift here in this impact parameter representation is just given by the iconal phase shift we determined a few slides ago.
Gamma is related to sigma.
Gamma is related to sigma. By sigma, you mean, yeah, yes. Yes. In fact, what happens is that the behavior, you see, this is, okay, let's see. At small cross ratios, what dominates this sum in the Lorentzian amplitude, it's large energy and spin, exactly as in flat space. And you can show that this sigma at large energy and spin is in fact determined by the anomalous dimension. So if you write this E as some E classical plus some gamma, or in fact plus 2 gamma in my notation, then this sigma will be just the derivative with respect to J of, with respect to energy, sorry, of the anomalous dimension. But I can tell about that later, otherwise I don't get to the end. So just, okay, but in fact I want to give another picture of why this gamma is the anomalous dimension, and this is an intuitive picture which we can understand without following the details of this limiting. So here you have the picture of the high energy scattering in ABS, where you have some impact parameter R and two very energetic particles. So this, it's a two-string state, should be dual to a double trace operator in the conformal field theory. And this, if you want the spin you put here in the number of derivatives between the two operators, is precisely the spin of this state in ABS. So now we should have a good classical description of this state, or at least semi-classical, at large charges, so at large energy and spin. So what we do is that, using our result, we just consider an evolution of this state over a 2π interval in global time. So should be some Hamiltonian that translates this in a global time interval of 2π. Gives you, so one acquires a phase due to the classical dimension of the state, even if it doesn't interact. But then, in a 2π translation, you get 2 times this picture. So from here to here, you have pi. So you have the square of the phase shift we just described between the two null geodesics. So you see, from this formula, we just understand that, in fact, this 2 gamma is the anomalous dimension of this double trace operator. So now we have a very precise and concrete prediction. So if you were take strong toothed coupling, then the anomalous dimensions of this double trace operators are given by this expression, where now S is E square minus J square. Remember that S was not energy square, was the scalar product of these null vectors, which if you go and check, it's E square minus J square. And R is this impact parameter, which is again related to the energy of a spin over energy by this formula. So, I mean, just to show you that this is very explicit, I mean, this propagator is known in any dimension as an hypergeometric function. And you can even go for d equals 2, d equals 4, right? And replace the values for n equals 4, and you have this prediction. I emphasize that this prediction it's exact in 1 over n. So at large values of E and J, This is the only correction in 1 over n. There's no, the 1 over n to the fourth correction is subdominant at large spin. Okay. It's just saying like the phase shift, the iconal determines the phase shift at large spin, the same result as in flat space. Okay, so before we go back to our map, let me just summarize what we found. So we found that the iconal approximation in ADS, so a resummation of all these ladder and cross-ladder graphs, corresponds to an impact parameter representation, which here I just represent by an integral like this, of an exponentiated phase shift, where the phase shift for pure gravity is given by this. So now, imagine we expand this, right? We can expand this exponential. So the one basically gives one in my notation, which corresponds to the disconnected amplitude. Then you have the phase shift itself. This is of order 1 over n square. This corresponds to single graviton exchange. So in fact, basically, the result is again as in flat space with the appropriate analogs. Given the single three-level exchange, it's enough. You write it in impact parameter space, in impact parameter representation, determine the phase shift, then exponentiate, and that's your iconal amplitude, exactly as in flat space. So okay, we learned this part over here, right? We learned how to exponentiate the phase shift related to three level, and we learned something very important, which is which observable do we mean by high energy scattering in ADS. So now let's start to include them. Maybe I should go back. So here now we want to move in this horizontal direction. So here, what will happen, as I already said, is that instead of changing only the gravity, we will exchange a full tower of power of particles with unbounded spin. So here we need Regi methods, so some kind of Regi theory to resum this infinite tower. So in Regi theory, again, as in flat space, is done in partial waves. So now the partial waves that are important are the T-channel partial waves. We should look at exchanges in this channel. Again, I mean, the expression is just the same. You can expand any four-point function of a conformal field theory in partial waves in any channel. And the important point is that if you take the Euclidean partial wave and you take the limit small zz bar, you get the OPE. So essentially, okay, in my notation, 2 plus z is the dimension. So it's just the zz bar to the dimension. But something completely different happens if you take the Lorentzian version of these partial waves. So take the partial wave, do analytic continuation, and compute the small zz bar behavior. Here you see this behavior as 1 minus j. So as sigma goes to 0, the largest the j, the more it diverges. So you have to sum over partial waves of unbounded spin, and the largest spin contributes much more. So it's dominant in principle. So you really need to Regi methods to sum this infinite sum. So, okay, I won't have time to show you the derivation in detail, but I guess you're also not interested, so I'll just sketch the basic fact, the basic points. So first, there's one difference from the usual Regi methods in flat space. You have another sum over E. So first you have to put this sum also as an integral. So introduce this function. So now we're going to do it for the Lorentzian function, because so we rotate this expression. And so we write this, and so J, this function J of nu has to have poles so that when you go to the poles, you recover this sum. Okay. So now after doing that, we can remove the sum over spins and trade it by an integral over this contour. So we use the usual sum of Earl-Watson representation. And again, we do the usual stuff. I mean, we deform this contour and pick up the leading Regi pole. So the Regi pole is given by the pole of this coefficient function. But now, the interesting point is that it's a function of nu, this other integral variable that we had to introduce. And so you do that, you pick up this pole, you take the limit of sigma going to zero, and you end up with this expression. So here you see that as sigma goes to zero, you have a Regi pole that dominates this behavior, but then this Regi pole is a trajectory, it's a function of nu. And this nu, what it is that, this is tough, so let's see, nu, it's some kind of measure of the effective mass of this harmonic function on H3. So now H3 appears again, if you want. So if you write z and z bar in this form, sigma is where you send to zero, rho is fixed, and the function of rho, this transverse space here, again appears naturally when expanded in harmonic functions in H3. So rho, I mean, when we write it like this, you don't know, but rho, in fact, is like a geodesic distance in hyperbolic tree space. Okay, now, I mean, hyperbolic tree space, now I'm being specific to four-dimensional case, too.
Rho is, would be T in
the bottom. Exactly.
We don't know what alpha mu does.
That's the point. So this is the generic expression. So what do we know? First let me tell you, okay, again we can do, okay, if this is just a single Regian exchange, let's see what's the phase shift associated with a single Regian exchange. So this is just writing it like an impact parameter representation and computing. So again you get another integral over nu. And now you see, you have the same functions on H3, but the variable changes. Now this R is really the impact parameter on H3. So now here, but that's why it's easy to change from one to the other, because you just do expand in harmonic function in H3. And okay, beta is another function, it's linearly related to alpha, but up to some known functions, I didn't try to. And we know something, so we know the case we just saw, right? For the graviton, we need j equals 2, and we need beta of this form, so that, this is the expansion of the propagator in harmonic functions in H3. So now we want to include alpha prime corrections. So we start by writing this function j of nu as an expansion, so it starts at 2, and then it has 1 over square root lambda corrections, so alpha prime correction. And what do we know? We know that if we take the flat space limit, then it has to give 2 plus alpha prime over 2 times t. So the flat space limit is here, so as you're saying, nu is precisely, so it's appropriate normalized, the L is the ADS radius, times square root t, so the momentum transfer. So if you take this limit, we know that j1 has to go to t over 2, and all the other functions have to go to 0 faster than, so basically they should be polynomial with a degree bounded by this expression, polynomials in u. And you know another thing, we know that this function, so this function encodes the effective spin, so the spin of each particle. So we know that the graviton is massless for any value of lambda. So we know that if you go back and see the 2 plus I nu was the dimension of the operator, of the dual operator. So when nu is equal to 2i, you have a dimension 4 operator, which is the energy momentum tensor, which has spin 2 at any value of lambda. So you know these two things. And this fixes this expression here, which was firstly written in a paper by Joe and Strassler, Brouwer, and Tan. And you can also extract the other coefficient, beta and the expansion, from the standard flat space string theory Regi amplitude. And okay, just to comment that here you see that as you include alpha prime corrections, we see that the effective spin at nu equals 0 decreases from 2.
The integral of a node goes up to 0.
Right? The minus infinity to plus infinity.
Plus infinity.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Okay. So then
the intercept is reduced in the ESO.
Yes. This was found by Joe 2 years ago or something. It's not a new result.
Opposite of QCD, where the intercept is
rather. Yeah, that's what I'm.
Supposed to approach QCD and decoupling, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to show here.
1 plus and 2 minus.
This is the story along this row here, so I'm going to precisely talk about that. So now let's go to the other limit. So let's go to weakly coupled CFTs, and we know what we should compute. We should compute the four-point function in this Lorentzian regime and look at small cross ratios. So first thing we did, this specific function that we pick for simplicity is known up to order lambda square, the full Euclidean amplitude. So you can just go and brute force rotate Euclidean continuate and take the small ZZ bar behavior. And this is the result. Essentially, what you get is that it doesn't depend on sigma, which corresponds to j equal 1, if you remember it was sigma to j minus 1. And then is this function of rho, which you can, just by expanding in harmonic functions, you get this expression. That's not very important. But we see that this result is just the leading result. It's just completely given just by exchanging two gluons. And now we need to proceed. And here, the way to proceed is to read some old literature from the 70s and learn about high energy scattering in gauge theories. So what happens is that if you start computing diagrams at large S, and you take large S, what you see is that, so as we saw, the leading order diagram doesn't depend on S. And then you start seeing logs. So when you increase the order in perturbation theory, you start seeing logs of S. So when you resum all these logs of S, you see that, so the diagrams that give these logs of S is when you include a ladder of regized gravitons exchanged along the T channel. So this is what is called the Hart-Pomeran. It's like this colorless state, which has the quantum numbers of the vacuum, and corresponds to this effective particle made out of gluons. Okay, so in our case, this brings me to this picture. So let's take the four-point function, four external operators, and now we are exchanging gluons like this. But the construction, the BFKL construction, amounts to say that essentially you have one function here, which is called the impact factor, which tells you how these external operators couples to two gluons, to transverse gluons. So this axis live in R2, so the two-dimensional transverse space of in a scattering person in four dimensions. Then you have a kernel, some BFKL kernel, here, depending on the positions of the gluons. And again, on the other side, you have another impact factor associated with the other particle. So in our language, what happens is that if you write your cross ratios using these points in Milne space, so P and P bar, you rewrite it like this, your impact factors become functions of, so this side of P, this side of P bar, and of this transverse positions of the gluons. And then you have the famous BFKL kernel. So now this expression here, the BFKL kernel is conformal invariant. So it has the same symmetries as a four-point function of zero-dimension operators. And also these impact factors have conformal properties, so that this integral, I mean, basically what we did was to use lots of conformal symmetry to evaluate these integrals. But okay, the point is that because of this conformal symmetry of the BFKL kernel, the appropriate way to write it is again expanded in appropriate functions, which are essentially conformal partial waves, and now in transverse space, because now everything is reduced by two dimensions. So essentially, this function can be expanded in two-dimensional conformal partial waves, and then you have a superposition which, in which each part, each function determines the effective spin, so the leading behavior sigma goes to zero of the kernel. This is like the appropriate way to write the kernel. So you see, the new integral was already there in the BFKL language. I mean, here, of course, everything appropriately normalized, but it was already there. So if you see you replace this kernel in this expression, you just have to do the transverse conformal integrals. Let me just recall that, again, this R2 should be thought as the boundary of hyperbolic tree space. So again, this conformality here, it's essential. And okay, after some work, quite a lot of work in fact, but you recover exactly the same form that we had from just Regi theory analysis. And now, okay, the spin is changed, and you have the usual BFKL spin. So, and as you were saying, the intercept rises. So this expression describes completely the first row, so the planar limit of this ADS CFC, and we know a lot about these functions J and alpha. We know them in both limits. Okay, and now I'm almost finishing because I don't have much to say about this. Just some comments on this. So in principle now, when we include 1 over n corrections, one should include, so how should I say it? From what we learn in this talk, one should say, okay, that's just exponentiating the phase shift in ADS. And perhaps that has some application. That's one of my questions. But what is understood from field theory computations is that you really need to include Pomeran self-interactions. So it's not enough to exchange soft Pomerans. You really need to include one Pomeran going to two Pomerans, like Pomeran vertices. In fact, another way to see this is in this dipole approach, you see that the gluon density in the hadron wave functions saturates due to nonlinear effects. So you have, for example, in deep inelastic scattering, the rays at small x, at small Bjorken x, saturates due to these nonlinear effects. Then you have, for example, this Balit-Kovshchov equation, which precisely describes the interaction between two Pomerans and one Pomeran, and which already gives rise to saturation. which it would be very interesting to see what it corresponds in this idea CFT setting. This is something we are working on at the moment. So, as I already said, if you just iconalize the Pomer in four dimensions, it doesn't work. What we are trying to see if it's... Yeah, so if you just think that at leading order in 1 over n you start exchanging soft Pomerans, apparently this doesn't work. You need to really include Pomeran going to two Pomerans, so Pomeran interactions.
But this is still all n equals infinity, right?
No, when here, no. If you don't include 1 over n effects, just one Pomeran. So I'm talking about moving in, I'm talking about 1 over n corrections for sure.
The fact that you're matching a 1 plus something to a 2 minus something is not a good meet. But if the higher order effects are supposed to use it as the Pomeran, then it's down again.
No, but not in the plane.
It's 1 over n.
But the problem is that unitarity is more a problem if you work at finite n. I mean, in this conformal limit, there's no Frasa bound. There, I mean, you can just move from J to 1 to 2. No?
So it's 1 over n.
Because the intercept is greater than 1. You mentioned 1 over n eventually becomes 4 because the energy is growing.
And if that starts bringing you down,
I don't know how to think about
how is that going to map? You say.
Well, they both actually there on the gravity in the gravity side. You know that the icon of conservation energy breaks down because you make black holes.
Right.
You didn't.
I'll just put it as an open question. Maybe I should finish because it's just two clicks.
Yeah.
So I have just two more open questions. So one is what you were saying. It's like if you go further down in 1 over n square, or if you really enter the strong gravity case, then you should be able to see black hole formation. And I think it's very interesting. I mean, people have studied lots of this problem in flat space. Here, ABS, in principle, it's more difficult because we have an extra scale, this radius of curvature. But on the other hand, we have the weakly coupled description. So is there anything we can learn from try to see if we can see something like black holes in the weakly coupled amplitudes at high energy? I don't know, this is also a question for the future. And another question is the unitarity. So I don't see any unitarity bound. So when you expand in partial waves in flat space, there is clearly unitarity bound. I mean, the coefficients are bounded by unitarity. But in a conformal partial wave expansion, as far as I know, there's no bound on the coefficients. So is there any unitarity bound? On the other hand, if you think in ADS and you do perturbative field theory in ADS, then everything like cutting rules works like in flat space. So it seems that there are some unitarity constraints. So this is again something that it's not clear to me.
Well, the unitarity constraints, just said there are higher order effects which are going to become important if you exceed 1 in just multiple scattering effects. There was the same as the saturation. We know that.
You say if you go to...
No matter how big n is, they're going to be electrical. Whether or not you... It's rigorous. It's unitary.
Yes. No, but I really mean another question I don't know, for example. If you take a flat space scattering amplitude, in a field theory, you have these unitarity bounds, for example, the total cross-section, the Frasa bound.
Yeah, but
right?
You require a gap.
Exactly. Yeah. Is there any similar or any similar in spirit bound for this Lorentzian amplitude in a conformal field theory? Is it bounded or no?
It's the same bound.
But there's no gap, as you said, there's no gap.
Yeah. You can see that on the gravity side as production of large black holes, basically. That's how you apparently get, well, you get a cross-section that saturates the pulsar band, because the size of the black hole goes with the energy like the law. Right.
So you say that you can only see it as a finite time effect, as a one over. If you do planarly, there's no bound at all. That's what you're saying.
Well, you see, actually, it's well, on the gravity side, it's kind of non-perturbative, right? Because the black holes are not perturbative objects.
So if you take n very, very much larger than the high energy you have, you never see a bound. You say that. Okay, I mean, I just finished with this picture. And thank you for listening.
There's something else that I never understood that my collaborators keep telling me, because in the Trolley-Gottlieb limit near two, things are simple and pretty familiar, and in particular, the phase is real. The Aikenhoff phase is real.
Right.
But as you go down towards intercept one, the Aikenhoff phase becomes imaginary.
Right, it's true.
And so somehow there's something going on, some creation of intermediate states or something beyond what, you know, what one sees in the strong coupling limit. It's more complicated.
I think this is what you mean. Is this I here?
Yeah.
This.
There's some relation, there's some direct relation actually between the intercept and the phase. So as I mean, the phase is real when the intercept is two, and it's purely imaginary when the intercept is one.
Right.
And so
it sort of has to be, because they're, you know, you're going from a trajectory which has a physical particle to one which doesn't. There's no online particle.
Right. Right. Okay.
So that's where things are.
So what it means physically too is that instead of the Aikenhoff being some just elastic phase as it is in the one case, it's absorptive. You've got some multi-channel process where you're mixing the channels. Is that eye there?
Yeah, I mean, this is the coefficient for the the amplitude, which is the same for the phase shift.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think it's called, I mean, something that's similar at large that we can struggle with, but I think the initialization might be qualitatively different. Just, I think different effects may come over the two limits.
Any other questions?